Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Candace, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop. And, well, actually, today's program is a collaborative effort between the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care. So it's really a Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop. And the program today is titled Update on Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia, or CLL, and Small Lymphocytic Lymphoma, SLL. And today's program is truly a collaborative effort with the Lymphoma Research Foundation, who really have been the architects for today's program and have really helped us to really choose the very best speakers and actually have been just very supportive in making this program possible. Now, because of all of this collaborative effort between these two organizations, and we do have other organizations out there who actually participate in many of our programs, we have over 630 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, Costa Rica, France, and the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So it's a bit of a global call, and it's really a credit to each of you that you have chosen to spend the next hour with us to learn more about this CLL-SLL. Now, today's program is supported through unrestricted educational grants to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Genentech, Biogen and Pharmaceutics, Inc., and AbbVie Company, and Janssen Biotech, Inc. And I really want to thank them and the Lymphoma Research Foundation for their support and also for the industry support of this program and the collaboration between industry to make this program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Richard Furman. Dr. Furman is Associate Professor of Medicine, Director, CLL Research Center, Weill Cornell Medical College, York Presbyterian Hospital. And Dr. Furman is going to begin by presenting an overview of chronic lymphocytic leukemia and small lymphocytic leukemia and current treatment options and new and emerging treatment approaches. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Furman.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and I'd like to thank Cancer Care and the LRF for making this opportunity available to just help educate everyone regarding these conditions. I'd like to sort of start with the very broad overview, which will hopefully help answer a lot of questions and help put things in perspective. CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and SLL, small lymphocytic lymphoma, are the same disease. And what they represent are a cancer of lymphocytes. Now, lymphocytes are one of the white blood cells that live in our bodies, and they like to circulate in the blood, the bone marrow, the lymph nodes, and the spleen. And as they do, they serve to protect us from infections. So the lymphocytes, which come in three types, B cells, T cells, and NK cells, exist together in the lymph nodes waiting for an infection to come. And when an infection comes, the lymphocytes will rapidly grow and divide and fight the infection. Once the infection's cleared, the lymphocytes die off. And that's why we sort of don't become a giant lymph node as we get older. And in fact, the number of lymphocytes you have when you're 80 is approximately the same number as you have as when you're 20. And that's one of the amazing things about the immune system that we don't understand. In CLL, mistake happens in one lymphocyte, and this is actually a B lymphocyte. And the B lymphocytes, which are normally responsible for making antibodies, which help fight bacteria and viruses, basically one of these B lymphocytes just starts to grow and divide and doesn't stop. And it's also not growing and dividing in response to an infection. So it might be making a lot of copies of itself, but these aren't helpful copies. So as the B cells grow and divide, they basically cause symptoms in one of four ways. The first and the most typical is just by taking up space. So the CLL lymphocytes will fill up a lymph node and cause lymphadenopathy. or they could fill up your spleen and cause splenomegaly, and the spleen is really just a giant lymph node in the abdomen. These cells can also fill up the blood and cause a high white count, what we call lymphocytosis, or they can fill up the bone marrow. And because the bone marrow is the site of where red cells and platelets are normally made, as the bone marrow fills up with CLL, sometimes the ability to make red cells and platelets is interfered with. And so that can result in anemia, or a low red cell count, and thrombocytopenia, a low platelet count. Now, as the CLL cells grow and divide, it's important to remember that where they reside can be due to a myriad of different factors, but they usually also travel from one location to another. And so it's important to remember that a lymphocyte that, or a CLL cell that might be in the blood today could have been in a lymph node yesterday and then back into a lymph node tomorrow. In 1993, we used to talk about a lymph node biopsy from a patient with CLL as being small lymphocytic lymphoma because it's in a lymph node, but a bone marrow biopsy from the same patient as being chronic lymphocytic leukemia because the disease is in the marrow. But this would be one patient who would, in essence, have two diseases. So in 1994, there was a new classification system put into place that combined CLL and SLL into one entity. And for simplistic terms, it's just called CLL/SLL. So it's really all-inclusive, and patients can present with one form, receive treatment, and then relapse with a different form. And so there's a lot of differences that we don't understand, but as far as we can tell, there's really nothing clinically relevant about the differences. Now, second from actually, so from the first way that CLL causes symptoms by taking up space, you can imagine that having a drop in your hemoglobin and platelet count could lead to development of symptoms, namely fatigue from a loss of red cells or thrombocytopenia or bleeding due to a lack of platelets. Additionally, as these cells fill up in the blood, it's important to remember that there's really not a dangerous white count level in the blood, and that the lymphocytes themselves can continually accumulate without really causing problems from the white cells getting stuck. And that's an interesting phenomenon that happens with other leukemias, but not CLL. So the second way that CLL patients experience symptoms, besides the cells taking up space, is that the cells themselves, because they don't work, and these CLL cells seem to impact the other cells of the immune system, CLL patients have a lot of they seem very immunosuppressed. And the immunosuppression results in a loss of what might be considered B cell function, namely antibody production, but also T cell function. So we see patients have hypogammaglobulinemia, which is a low antibody level, and that can sometimes result in recurrent infections, most commonly chronic sinusitis or chronic bronchitis. But because of the T-cell defect, we also see issues that are unrelated to the antibody levels, namely shingles, which is more common in CLL patients, as well as pneumocystis pneumonia. And so even though this is a B-cell lymphoma, there definitely seem to be problems that affect all the arms of the immune system. The third way that CLL patients become symptomatic is that there's an increased risk of autoimmunity. Now, the thing that's important to remember about this autoimmunity is that it's directed against blood targets only. So because of all the B cells in the blood, antigens or proteins are having antibodies made against them, which normally shouldn't be made. So in a normal immune system, you'll make antibodies against bacteria and viruses because your B cells will recognize those as not yourself. But in a CLL patient, antibodies will be made against red cells and platelets because the B cells aren't able to make that recognition anymore. So these antibodies against red cells can cause an autoimmune hemolytic anemia, and the antibodies against the platelets can cause immune thrombocytopenia or ITP. And both of these could lead to destruction of the red cells or platelets. The fourth way that we see symptoms in CLL is that sometimes the cells will make chemicals. And these chemicals, which might be responsible for normally making fevers or make the body sweat or make the body lose weight, could be made excessively and inappropriately and can cause people to have fevers, chills, night sweats, weight loss, what we call these B symptoms. And those are really made by chemicals we call cytokines from the CLL cells. So these four ways that patients have of developing symptoms related to their CLL, namely taking up space, autoimmunity, immunodeficiency, and the creation of B symptoms, happen at various rates in patients with CLL. So based upon data that was generated a long time ago, the goal is always to watch and wait patients until it looks like they're going to develop symptoms. And so we would often wait and let the disease accumulate, and until we started to see signs of the disease becoming active, we just observe patients. Now, one of the things that I think that's important for people to keep in mind is the data that was generated back in the 70s and 80s suggested that there's no benefit to early treatment. One of the things to keep in mind is that the treatments we had back then were certainly not nearly efficacious as they are today, but they were also toxic in the form of them being chemotherapy. Nowadays, with all of our new agents that are very effective and not chemotherapy, the concerns about starting treatment are much lower. And I think it's important to not delay therapy too long, because sometimes I see patients waiting too long and actually running into trouble before starting therapy. Now, discussing the different types of treatment options that we currently have, the old standby are what we would consider, or what we would call chemotherapy. And chlorambucil was the first chemotherapeutic agent that we really had. And this was quickly replaced by fludarabine, and then fludarabine and cyclophosphamide as a combination. So fludarabine and fludarabine cyclophosphamide were, in the early 90s, the standard treatments. And to those regimens, we added rituximab. And rituximab is an antibody that, in essence, binds to and kills the B cells. So normally, B cells make antibodies against bacteria and viruses. Rituximab is an antibody that was made in a laboratory against the B cells. And so when we use it in combination with the fludarabine and cyclophosphamide, it can actually bind and kill the B cells and, in fact, help make the chemotherapy more efficacious without increasing the risks to the patient, because they are very targeted to the cells specifically that we're interested in targeting. Now, subsequent to the addition of rituximab to fludarabine and cyclophosphamide, creating what would be either FCR or FR, bendamustine, which is a chemotherapy agent that was developed in the 70s but not really used until the 90s and the 2000s, became available. And bendamustine plus rituximab is also a regimen commonly used. Bendamustine is a chemotherapy agent like fludarabine, and is very, and both fludarabine and bendamustine are very effective, but they are associated with a lack of specificity. And so there's always a risk of damage to the bone marrow and to other tissues in the body. What really has been so great more recently has been the development of more targeted therapies. So we've had two new antibodies generated. One is ofatumumab, which is an antibody that targets the same protein as rituximab, namely CD20. The second is obinutuzumab, and obinutuzumab is actually just a newer version of rituximab, so it also targets CD20, but it seems to be more effective at activating the immune system and in killing the cells that it binds to. But then going one step further, we've developed what we would call now small molecule inhibitors, or even biologically targeted molecules. So we have two groups, the B-cell receptor antagonists or BCL2 antagonists. Now, the B-cell receptor antagonists, which include ibrutinib and idelalisib, both bind to inhibit one particular enzyme. So for ibrutinib, it is Bruton's tyrosine kinase, or BTK, and for idelalisib, it is the phosphatidyl inositol 3 kinase, or PI3 kinase. Both those enzymes are very important to what's called the B-cell receptor signaling pathway, which seems to be very important in keeping the CLL cells alive. Now, by inhibiting those enzymes, we're able to actually have a marked impact on CLL survival without a tremendous effect on other cells, either because the enzymes don't exist in the other cells or the pathway is not as important to the health of those other cells. And so the ability to target these individual enzymes really has enabled us to have very effective therapies that have been very well tolerated. So currently, the approved therapies that are most commonly used in the United States include fludarabine, cyclophosphamide, and rituxan, or FCR, FR, fludarabine and rituxan, or BR, bendamustine rituxan, for those patients who are going to get chemotherapy. For patients who are just going to get immunotherapy, it's going to either be, as I mentioned, obinutuzumab, rituximab, and ofatumumab. And then we also have now approved for all CLL patients, ibrutinib, and approved for patients who are really not candidates for other therapies, idelalisib plus rituximab. Now, those are all the approved indications based upon the FDA. What's always important for everyone to keep in mind is that once a drug is approved, it can be used in any means that benefits the patient. So just because, you know, idelalisib is only approved for in combination with rituximab for patients who are unable to tolerate any other therapies, if your physician feels that idelalisib is the best agent for you, that's certainly something that should be sought out and looked into. And I think that's a very important thing to keep in mind because the FDA approvals are really based upon how drugs are basically packaged and provided to the FDA for approval and not based upon any treatment recommendation. So even when ibrutinib was only approved initially for 17p deleted CLL, or even when it was just approved for mantle cell lymphoma, I was still using that in patients of mine who had CLL that wasn't 17p deleted, if I thought that those patients would be best served by ibrutinib. And so that's an important thing to keep in mind when we talk about the different therapies that are available and how to use these different therapies to actually treat patients. So with that being said, I'm actually going to turn the mic back over to Dr. Mesner, who's going to move on to the second part of our discussion today.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Furman, for a really outstanding overview of CLL, SLL, and just many of the treatments and new treatments available. So thank you. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Excellent. And our next speaker is Dr. Nadia Khan. Dr. Khan is Assistant Professor, Department of Hematology Oncology, Fox Chase Cancer Center. And Dr. Khan is going to be addressing clinical trial updates, communicating with the healthcare team, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Khan.
Carolyn, thank you so much for the kind introduction. It's such a pleasure to be speaking to you and the audience today, and I wanted to thank Dr. Furman for providing a really wonderful overview of CLL. As Dr. Furman just outlined, CLL is a disease in which active surveillance is appropriate until there are signs that treatment is needed. And this is a very exciting time in the therapeutic landscape of CLL. Within the past few years, we have seen an unprecedented number of therapies come forward. In large part, this renaissance in CLL treatments has occurred because of advances in the understanding of the biology of CLL, the role of the B-cell receptor, and the identification of proteins in the CLL cells that promote survival really were some of the first steps in the development of the new targeted therapies in CLL. The new treatments in CLL often are available in pill form and are not classified as traditional chemotherapies per se. And I'm really excited as a clinician by the prospect of targeted therapies that preferentially impact CLL or SLL cells and don't have serious or major side effects that we traditionally associate with classical chemotherapies. And though the agents are very well tolerated overall, there are side effects that are associated with these newer agents, and there is a level of vigilance that is required with all chemotherapies or novel therapies. Any new event that occurs during therapy for a patient should be reported to your CLL physician to understand better if this is something that's arising from a newer therapy or is unrelated to the treatment and perhaps is due to your CLL or something else. Chemotherapy still has an important role in CLL for some patients, but its applicability for patients has narrowed with the advent of targeted therapies. Trials are important in CLL because we want to improve on outcomes and are hopeful for eventually curative therapies with improvement in ongoing toxicities. And clinical trials help us all move toward that goal. The newest treatments are not available to patients right away, and as they're studied in clinical trials, some patients would have access to these agents. All patients who need treatment and are enrolled on trial would receive treatment. A patient would not be randomized or placed on a placebo or sham treatment. For this particular disease that has so many beneficial treatment options available. Because there are a number of treatments to choose from, a discussion with your CLL doctor may help you to find the treatment strategy that is best suited to you and your particular CLL. Treatments are tailored to patients based on the assessment of a patient's tolerability of a given intervention, and we use age, other health conditions, overall general health, and the patient's history regarding other therapies used to treat their CLL or other diseases that helps us to determine what therapies are possible or safest. And secondly, and perhaps equally important, the kind of CLL that is found will also guide the treatment options. Genetic testing of the CLL with a FISH, F-I-S-H test, is an important prerequisite to choosing a treatment. If your CLL was analyzed in the past, but not recently, your doctor may want to retest the CLL. And this is a blood test. Bone marrow biopsy is not needed if there are circulating CLL cells. The most impactful FISH test results would include the finding of a 17p deletion, so a missing short arm on chromosome 17, which means that the CLL cells are likely to be resistant to conventional chemotherapies. Fortunately, though, there are highly effective treatments available for patients who have 17p deletion, including the pill that Dr. Furman mentioned, ibrutinib, also called Imbruvica, which is a drug that blocks an enzyme that's downstream from the B-cell receptor. With all of the new agents available, including targeted agents, chemotherapies, amongst those, the question of when is the best time to start using a novel therapy remains unanswered. There are large clinical trials designed to answer this particular question. We don't have the results as yet, but the trials were designed so that patients could receive either traditional chemotherapy in the case of one study, FCR was compared with ibrutinib, and another study, there were three arms in which bendamustine with rituximab BR was compared with another arm, rituximab and ibrutinib, and the third arm was ibrutinib alone. So we're looking forward to the results of that study to help us better understand perhaps what the best strategy is for patients who have not previously received any therapy for their CLL. Ibrutinib, as Dr. Furman also mentioned, is FDA approved for all patients with CLL or SLL. It's a pill which is taken every day until either the drug stops working to control the CLL or there are bad side effects that make it virtually impossible to continue on the therapy. Ibrutinib has been studied in patients with relapsed CLL, that's CLL that's been treated in the past but has come back, and in patients who have never been treated. And the drug is very effective at reducing the amount of CLL in the body in patients who are treated with the drug. And patients have lived longer as a result of treatment with ibrutinib. This is a drug that is very effective in patients with the 17p deletion that I mentioned earlier. And though it's less effective than if there was no 17p deletion, this drug has become the first-line choice in patients with 17p deletion if possible. As with other novel or targeted therapies, it is dosed continuously. The drug rarely results in a complete response. A complete response means there's no detectable CLL in the body. Instead, the majority of patients have partial responses and still do very well and live longer while on the drug. Ibrutinib can therefore be thought of as a type of a maintenance therapy that keeps the CLL controlled as long as it is being given. Some side effects of ibrutinib to consider include diarrhea, which is usually mild and can be controlled with antidiarrheal agents, rash, joint swelling and pain, bruising, and increased rates of bleeding. Atrial fibrillation has also been reported in about 6% of patients treated with ibrutinib. The cause of the bleeding seems to be due to the drug's effect on platelet function. Platelets are a part of the blood that help the blood to clot. Ibrutinib should be held for anywhere from 3 to 7 days, both before and after a surgical procedure, depending on if it is a minor or a major procedure. An important observation in patients treated with ibrutinib, and something that we also see with the use of idelalisib, another targeted therapy in pill form that was mentioned by Dr. Furman and which I will discuss momentarily, is a rise in the white blood cell count, usually peaking in the first month to 2 months after treatment has begun, and then over time can decrease to normal. And we have noticed that the lymph nodes that begin to decrease in size while patients are treated with ibrutinib are decreasing as a result of lymphocyte egress. The lymphocytes are leaving the lymph node and entering the circulation, entering the blood. And when we see this peaking of the lymphocyte count with these newer therapies, with the new pills, we know that the drug is working, and this is not something that should prompt worry or discontinuation of the drug. There are ongoing trials with combinations that include ibrutinib, and ibrutinib is being combined with the monoclonal antibody obinutuzumab and is also being combined with venetoclax, the BCL-2 inhibitor. We're looking forward to those results. Ibrutinib is a BTK inhibitor, so it inhibits an enzyme downstream from the B-cell receptor. And the next generation BTK inhibitor is being studied with some results from early phase clinical trials already published within this year, showing that the drug acalabrutinib, also called ACP-196, is even more selective in hitting the BTK, the Bruton's tyrosine kinase target, and potentially resulting in less side effects as compared with ibrutinib. We await the results of larger studies with ACP-196 or acalabrutinib, and this is a drug that may be available in the near future for patients who need it even after ibrutinib therapy, and it is being compared directly to ibrutinib in large studies. Idelalisib is a novel oral targeted therapy directed against an alternative kinase that's downstream from the B-cell receptor. The kinase is called PI3-delta kinase. This is a drug that was studied with rituximab and then is dosed continuously as long as it's working. This is a regimen that can be given to patients who have relapsed after another therapy or who were treated with ibrutinib and had to stop for either a bad toxicity, a bad side effect, or because the ibrutinib stopped working. Idelalisib and rituximab can be used in patients with 17p deletion after ibrutinib, which would be used as a first line if possible. Side effects of idelalisib include rash, pneumonitis, and diarrhea. The diarrhea can occur early on in therapy or late at around 7 months after treatment has begun. Late diarrhea tends to be more severe, and there appears to be an inflammatory colitis in patients who have had colonoscopy with this diarrhea. The severe colitis has resulted in some deaths, and when diarrhea begins, it's something that warrants higher vigilance and attention to the control of the diarrhea, which may include antidiarrheal agents, in some cases, oral steroids. There are other infectious concerns with idelalisib therapy. CMV, which is a virus that is essentially ubiquitous, can reactivate with use of the drug, and CMV monitoring, which is a blood test, is required monthly. If the CMV PCR, which is the blood test that's used to monitor the virus, becomes positive, then the drug needs to be discontinued. While patients are treated with idelalisib, there is also need for an antimicrobial that protects against pneumocystis, which can cause a type of pneumonia. The patients would be required to be on a form of an antibiotic that they can tolerate to help prevent this complication that was seen in patients treated with idelalisib. Duvelisib is another kinase inhibitor. It's a gamma-delta kinase inhibitor that is in development. It has activity in CLL and SLL, and it may be available in the near future for patients. Venetoclax, also called ABT-199, is another oral therapy. It targets BCL-2, which is an anti-apoptotic protein. This drug has been FDA approved for a narrow therapeutic indication, which is patients with 17p deletion that has relapsed, or you can think of its use in any relapsed patient who develops 17p deletion. This drug will likely achieve a broader FDA approval in the near future. It is currently included in the NCCN guidelines for all relapsed refractory CLL/SLL patients. This is a drug that requires continuous dosing as well. And the safety caveat here is tumor lysis risk, as well as neutropenia, which is the most common hematologic toxicity seen with the drug. Tumor lysis is what happens when the CLL cells or the SLL cells die very quickly, too quickly for the body to cope. And this can result in an elevation in the creatinine, which means that there's been an impact on the kidney function, and there can be a rise in electrolytes that can be very dangerous for heart function. That's why there's a dose ramp-up phase with venetoclax that allows for more safe administration and a decreased likelihood of tumor lysis. It's a drug that requires frequent blood monitoring for tumor lysis, depending on how much CLL is present, as would be assessed by measurement of lymph nodes, bulky lymph nodes, and a higher circulating lymphocyte count would suggest higher risk of tumor lysis. Patients may be started on therapy in the hospital if they are deemed to have a high risk of tumor lysis, and in that way they could receive IV hydration and frequent monitoring versus therapy at home, which is possible with this drug, which would also require frequent laboratory checks at each dose ramp-up phase. The drug provides an excellent treatment option for patients who have 17p deletion that has relapsed either after ibrutinib or chemotherapy. Obinutuzumab or Gazyva is a monoclonal antibody which is the next generation of rituximab. It's an antibody that also recognizes the CD20 protein on CLL, but it's different from rituximab in the way that it binds to immune effector cells, pulling them closer to the CLL and allowing the CLL to be cleared away. There's a large randomized study that was conducted in Europe demonstrating that the combination of Gazyva with chlorambucil, chlorambucil being the older chemotherapy that is an alkylator and a pill, this combination resulted in greater disease control and even resulted in some complete responses in a number of patients. Gazyva with chlorambucil is an appropriate consideration in some patients, particularly those patients in whom chemotherapy is not considered to be a safe or well-tolerated option. In patients certainly who have multiple medical conditions or who appear to be frail, this is a combination that may be very effective. transplant for CLL patients is an option and may be appropriate for specific patients who don't have other therapeutic options, and may be something to discuss in particularly very young CLL patients who have 17p deletion and who may eventually need this modality at some point in the future. This is a controversial area within CLL treatment options because of the number of newer, relatively tolerable therapeutic options available, which may allow us to delay transplant and perhaps do without it altogether for a particular patient. CAR T cells are another area of clinical development and research at this time in which patients have their T cells removed, and in the lab these are engineered to recognize proteins on the B cell, and then these are reinfused back into the patient, allowing the T cells to then recognize the CLL cells and help clear them away. There have been small numbers of patients studied and some ongoing complete responses, certainly with this method. CAR T cell therapy is highly immunosuppressive, and the technology is being refined to help target proteins specific to the CLL cells and thereby have less off-target effects and allow normal immune cells to continue to grow and function and hopefully result in less immunosuppression. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Khan. That was really incredibly comprehensive and just wonderful information for everybody about really all the new promising areas in terms of clinical trials, and just very, very explicit. So thank you very much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, and although our operator has not yet actually told people how to queue for questions, we're getting online questions, but very soon our operator will be able to tell people how to queue for questions so everyone knows what to do. And our next speaker is Mr. Maxwell Mulcahy. Mr. Mulcahy is Senior Director of Patient and Professional Programs for Lymphoma Research Foundation. And I have to say that Mr. Mulcahy and the Lymphoma Research Foundation have really been the architects and the supporters of today's program. I really want to really thank them for that. And I now want to turn this program over to Mr. Mulcahy, who's going to discuss actually all of the many Lymphoma Research Foundation programs and conferences. And also, we'll talk about the LRF helpline as well. So it's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Mr. Mulcahy.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and to CancerCare for our continued partnership. I would also like to thank our esteemed faculty, Dr. Richard Furman from Weill Cornell Medicine and Dr. Nadia Khan from Fox Chase Cancer Center. Thank you both for sharing your time and expertise today and to everything you do to support the Lymphoma Research Foundation and people affected by chronic lymphocytic leukemia. I would also like to acknowledge our corporate sponsors, Genentech, Biogen, Pharmacyclics, and AbbVie Company, and Janssen Biotech for supporting today's call. And last but not least, I would like to thank each of you for joining us on today's teleconference. As some of you may know, the Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest nonprofit organization devoted to funding innovative research and serving the lymphoma and CLL communities. LRF's mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by this disease. And we achieve this mission by providing comprehensive education programs, outreach initiatives, and patient services. The foundation remains dedicated to identifying potentially life-saving therapies for lymphoma and CLL through an aggressively funded research program that is guided by LRF scientific leadership, who are among the world's leading experts in lymphoma. LRF invests millions of dollars each year to combat lymphoma and CLL and has played a key role in accelerating the understanding and treatment of chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Today, LRF has funded nearly $60 million in lymphoma-specific research. The foundation remains committed to providing comprehensive, disease-specific resources, programs, and services to those who have been affected by a lymphoma diagnosis. And some of these resources include the Lymphoma Helpline, where our professionally trained staff can assist you in your search for CLL disease and treatment information, resources, and other support services, a clinical trials information service, which provides information about clinical trials, and then we'll do the legwork to help identify a trial appropriate for your diagnosis and in your geographic area, and a lymphoma support network, which is a national one-to-one peer support program that pairs lymphoma and CLL patients or caregivers with those who have had a similar lymphoma experience. Disease specificity is the hallmark of the foundation, and we offer a variety of CLL-specific resources, which include comprehensive disease guides specifically on CLL biology and treatment options, CLL-specific fact sheets in both the frontline and refractory settings, as well as on supportive care, informational disease-specific e-newsletters, webcasts, podcasts, and videos, and a dedicated CLL website. And the URL for that is focusonCLL.org, which offers disease and treatment information, as well as inspiring stories from CLL survivors. We also offer an award-winning mobile app called Focus on Lymphoma. The app provides patients and caregivers with comprehensive biology and treatment information on their lymphoma subtype, as well as a tool to help manage their diagnosis and treatment side effects. The Focus on Lymphoma mobile app allows users to record their doctor sessions, manage medications, track blood work, and document treatment side effects. And it's available for free download in the Apple App Store and in Google Play. So I'd encourage you to download the app today. I hope you take advantage of some of these great resources and services. I also want to invite you to join us on November 17th from 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time for an important teleconference on the advances in immunotherapy. For more information on LRF's chronic lymphocytic leukemia program, services, and resources, or to register for the upcoming immunotherapy teleconference, you can call our helpline, which is toll-free at 800-500-9976, or visit our website at lymphoma.org. So thank you very much for your time today.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Mr. Mulcahy, and thank you so much for all the work of the Lymphoma Research Foundation. This is an amazing resource for everybody on the call. I think many of you are familiar with the Lymphoma Research Foundation, but if you're not, definitely do take advantage of their services. Before we take questions, I would just like to say a few words about cancer care. Cancer care is an organization that provides free supportive counseling services, psychosocial services to people living with all types of cancer and hematologic cancers. And indeed, we have a staff of oncology social workers, all of whom are trained and licensed, and they are to provide a host of different services. So some practical assistance, to financial assistance, to actually someone to talk to about your concerns. We do have a number of different types of groups. We have groups that are done on the telephone, and also groups that are done actually online, and they're available to both to people living with cancer, as well as people living with, as well as their caregivers. We also have a number of these programs. I think Max mentioned some upcoming programs we have together. There's a lot of different workshops, and we have a lot of different publications, and of course, an active website. We definitely, and I think between Mr. Mulcahy and myself, what we don't want is for anyone to feel they're alone in coping with CLL/SLL. We want you to know you're part of this really extensive community of support, and that there are services available for you, both from the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care, so that you can get the support you need and get all the care that you need. So with that being said, I now would like to actually ask Candace to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. We have lots of questions already in queue, so I will also at the end of the call, and if we don't get to your questions, although we'll do our best to do the best with that, we will actually give you resources to go to get your questions answered. So, Candace, could you bring all of our speakers on board, and if you could explain to everybody how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Robert V. Your line is now open.
Hello. My question is for Dr. Furman. Could you please clarify or expand a little bit about the relationship between chronic lymphocytic leukemia and chronic bronchitis? Is that an infection that is caused at sometimes by CLL?
Thank you for that question, Robert. And Dr. Furman, if you could address that.
So I think the thing that's most important to keep in mind is the expression that common things occur commonly. And so there are a lot of people out there without CLL who have chronic bronchitis. So it's certainly a very common phenomenon that can relate to a lot of problems with the way the sinuses are structured or the bronchi and the lungs are structured. But what we do know is that about 70% of patients with CLL will have hypogammaglobulinemia, so they'll have low antibody levels. And because of the low antibody levels, we actually see an increased risk of having chronic bronchitis. Now, the thing that's important to keep in mind is it's just the antibodies normally serve an important role in keeping the bronchioles open and free of infection. And so just not having enough there in the blood sort of creates problems that allow the bacteria to grow and divide and to create that worse problems. We also know that if patients are symptomatic enough and they have low antibody levels, giving them gammaglobulin infusions, or IVIG, can actually replace the antibodies they're missing and can help prevent these infections.
Thank you. And our next question comes from David M. Your line is now open.
Hello. This would be for either doctor to answer. Either Dr. York or Dr. Khan. I had, and this was 2.5 years ago, I did bendamustine and rituximab, and I became neutropenic for quite a while after that, about a six-month period. And I'm at the point now where my physician is recommending that I restart a treatment, and we have discussed ibrutinib as a treatment. So my question is just a little twofold. I'm wondering what the instance of neutropenia relative to ibrutinib is and if there's any downside of starting ibrutinib too early.
Thank you for that question, an excellent question. Dr. Khan, do you want to address that question to begin with?
Yes. We've seen instances of longstanding neutropenia after bendamustine therapy, and it may be that the bendamustine has impacted the stem cell repertoire, and that's causing this neutropenia versus another possibility, which is an autoimmune clearance of the neutrophils, which is a little bit harder to decipher. I don't know if you've had a bone marrow biopsy to evaluate this question and to understand better what your bone marrow picture looks like. But to answer the question regarding cytopenias and ibrutinib, thankfully, neutropenia is not commonly seen with ibrutinib. So ibrutinib should not continue to impact your neutrophil numbers in a negative way.
Thank you. And we have a question for one of our online participants from Renee.
Actually, I would just like to add one thing to that,
yes,
if I may.
Yes.
So it's always important to remember that, you know, we can see anything with any treatment, and it's just important to make sure to recognize whether or not it's something that would be expected. And we do see neutropenia with ibrutinib, and so it would be expected, but it tends to be a very different neutropenia than what we see with the patients who are getting chemotherapy, and it seems to be much better tolerated and associated with a far lower risk of infections. So not all neutropenias are equal. And just because we see it, you know, doesn't mean that if it happened with one that it should recur with the other.
Excellent point. Thank you. And we have a question for our online participants from Renee for Dr. Furman. It's important not to wait too long to start therapy. How do we determine this when symptoms of CLL are virtually not existent? Dr. Furman, could you address that?
So I think it's important to keep in mind that the data that drove us to watch and wait is based upon those studies that I mentioned done in the 1970s and 80s. And what really is, I think, the key is to really separate out those patients who are going to have a disease that becomes active or is becoming active from those patients whose disease is remaining indolent. So everyone's disease will often progress at a slow rate, and then at some point that rate will start to increase. And it's, you know, intervening then before, you know, that's the important thing, is to not intervene in a patient whose disease is not progressing. But once someone's disease does start to progress, either they start showing a doubling of their white cells or the accumulation of significant lymphadenopathy or splenomegaly, or the beginning of an anemia and thrombocytopenia, and that usually is a hemoglobin less than 11 or a platelet count less than 100,000, you know, there it's the idea that they might not, they don't have symptoms yet, but the goal is to intervene before the symptoms arise. So you really want to keep people feeling well and prevent them from developing symptoms. And I think that often, you know, a lot of people deal with a lot of fatigue or deal with a lot of discomfort believing that every day they delay therapy is a day more they get at the other end. And that's really not true. The idea is that when therapy is indicated, it's actually advantageous to start therapy, and that there's no added benefit from delaying. And sometimes when people delay too long, they can have so much more tumor burden that they can start running into problems with their kidneys or their spleen and other issues that really preclude them from really being able to receive optimal therapy.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And our next telephone question, Candice.
And our next question comes from the line of Harvey S. Your line is now open.
This question is for Dr. Furman. I know you've already mentioned that immunoglobulin therapy is probably the best avenue of defense against chronic bronchitis, but I was wondering, as I find that most ENT doctors are woefully deficient in knowledge of CLL, are there any other procedures that might be done in the nasal cavity that might help defend against chronic bronchitis and sinusitis?
So I definitely, for every patient of mine who is having issues with chronic sinusitis and chronic bronchitis, I always make sure that they see an ENT physician first, because if there's some anatomical obstruction, like a deviated septum or chronic inflammation that's preventing the sinuses from draining, all the immunoglobulin in the world isn't going to be able to overcome that. So I do make sure that everyone gets evaluated by the ENT doctor. And sometimes these people with a simple nasoplasty or septoplasty or even just a procedure to open up the sinuses could actually avoid having recurrence of the chronic sinusitis and bronchitis and not need the gamma globulin therapy.
Excellent. And our next telephone question?
And our next question comes from David B. Your line is now open.
Yes. Why isn't Gazyva reasonable for frontline therapy for untreated, unmutated, under 65 patients? And from my understanding, there's been an average of 4 years treatment-free time period. And is there really need to combine it with chlorambucil, or is it really the Gazyva doing the work? Thank you.
Thank you for that question. Dr. Khan, could you address that question?
Sure. So the combination of Gazyva with chlorambucil was studied in patients who were typically older, and certainly to be enrolled on the CLL-11 study had to have multiple medical problems. And given the patient population in which the combination of drugs was studied, evaluated, and proven to be successful, it makes sense that that's where the indication lies. Because there are other treatment strategies for younger people that have been looked at, including FCR for patients with favorable risk features, and we know that there can be prolonged disease-free intervals of 10 or more years with FCR in young, fit patients who have good prognostic features, that's a preferred treatment for some patients in the minds of certain CLL experts. And certainly that would be a favorite approach that I would recommend for a young, fit patient. For patients who are older but can't necessarily, wouldn't be good candidates for a fludarabine-based regimen or FCR in particular, bendamustine rituximab is an excellent option for an abbreviated course of therapy. So you're talking about 6 months of therapy. And ibrutinib is an indefinite therapy that can be started in patients. I typically do reserve that for older patients who would not be candidates for chemotherapy.
Thank you. And another
I would just like
question. Yes.
Let me
yes.
just add one thing to that. I think that's a very demonstrative example of what I had mentioned earlier, whereas obinutuzumab was approved based off a study, the CLL 10 study, that actually looked at patients who were basically, you know, unable to tolerate chemotherapy due to other comorbidities. And the idea is that that's the population it was studied in, so that's the population it's approved for. But that doesn't mean that's the only population it should be used for. So if you and your physician think that obinutuzumab is the right choice for you and you're not that patient population, that doesn't mean it shouldn't be used for you. It's just that's the population that was studied, and so that's how it is approved.
Thank you. And we have a question from one of our online participants, from Deborah. Would you recommend testing for the BTK mutations, which might lead to ibrutinib resistance, especially for someone who is at risk? Dr. Furman, could you address that question?
So I don't believe in testing for the BTK mutations in patients before ibrutinib therapy or while on ibrutinib therapy. I think it's important to recognize that we've never found pre-existing BTK mutations, and that the thing that's more important is actually just seeing, is waiting for the CLL progression. So when a patient has a response to ibrutinib and then starts to progress, that's when I would look for the BTK mutation, more so that I know that this progression is real and is not going to likely be a transient phenomenon. But we've never seen it before ibrutinib therapy, and as long as the patient's continuing to respond, it really isn't relevant.
Thank you. And two late-breaking questions, one from one of our online participants, and I'm going to ask Mr. Mulcahy to address this. So the question is how to promote adult clinical trials of new promising therapies, and I wondered if, Mr. Mulcahy, if you could discuss that, because I know that LRF does so much work in this area.
Yeah, the Lymphoma Research Foundation is very committed to enrolling more patients in clinical trials, which is why we offer our clinical trial information service through our LRF helpline. And through that process, you can speak with one of the trained social workers that we have who can describe a little bit more about clinical trials and what they're looking for, as well as try to find an appropriate trial and link them with the investigator and institution that is doing the trial. And if patients have any questions, of course, you know, our helpline is available to them 5 days a week from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Thank you. And last question, which we do have a program coming up on this on November 17th, but still, from Patty, are there any immunotherapy agents being developed for CLL, SLL? Dr. Khan, if you could address that, please.
There are a variety of immune-directed or immune-related therapies that are being evaluated preclinically and in early clinical development. There are some small molecule inhibitors that are being looked at in CLL, and there are other immune therapies in the form of monoclonal antibodies, some in conjugation with cytotoxic agents that are being looked at in CLL. So absolutely, there are a number of immune therapies in development for CLL, and that's outside of CAR T-cell therapy, which, as I mentioned, is in ongoing development. So to answer the question about, you know, perhaps what's available for you, I think clinicaltrials.gov is an excellent resource if you're not connected with a larger academic center that can help point you in the right direction and help you find a trial that's best suited for you and for your CLL. Clinicaltrials.gov can be a way to filter through many of the trials that are out there in the world for CLL. And again, I think it's very important to have someone, your CLL doctor, to discuss as far as what trial makes sense for your particular disease.
Thank you. Dr. Furman, did you wish to add anything? Or?
No.
Okay, all right. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. This has been an extraordinary call, so I want to thank our speakers. I also want to thank all of you, both our telephone people who ask questions on the telephone and many of the online questions as well, an extraordinary group of participants on this call, and all of you who have been listening as well. I do, of course, want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour workshop and that in planning this program with the Lymphoma Research Foundation, we recognize that you have many questions and concerns that will continue both during the call and after the call. And so I importantly want to be sure that you have a place to call with any questions that you have that are going to be focused, get you a place to call to get help with answering those questions. So I very much recommend that you would call certainly the Lymphoma Research Foundation's helpline at 1-800-500-9976. It's a wonderful place to start with your questions, and they will be able to direct you to any other resources. And, of course, your treating healthcare team is an amazing resource for you as well, of course. Also, I do want to remind all of you that we do have a program coming up, actually on November 17th, on advances in immunotherapy, Advances in Immunotherapy in the Treatment of Lymphoma, and that program is, of course, one that many of you have signed up for, but if you haven't, please do. And again, I want to, as we conclude the call, I don't want any one of you to think that you are alone in coping with a CLL, SLL. I want you to know that you're now part of a really large community of support. You do have the Lymphoma Research Foundation as a base to contact, certainly, a wonderful resource, and, of course, Cancer Care. So I just want you to not feel you have to have an urgent matter to call any one of us or to contact us or visit our website. Please do that. Again, I wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all for being on the call today.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may all disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.